This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. This is Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Innovative thoughts from baseball's best coaching minds from around the world. Brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. Now your host, former USA Baseball National Team Coach, Peter Caliendo.
Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, wherever you're at in the U.S. and around the world. Welcome to Baseball Outside the Box. And as you know, I'm your host, Pete Caliendo. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. Again, I keep telling you, over 100 countries, coaches, players, and play, and parents listening to the show. We really appreciate it. And also watching it on YouTube and on Facebook. And remember, if you're on Facebook right now, go ahead. If you have any questions during the show, go ahead and ask them in the comments section. Hope you got some great questions because we're talking pitching today. So hang tight and don't forget ESPN Honolulu. Thank you, everybody, for being on the show and listening and watching. I really appreciate it. Along with, don't forget, just do us one favor. Go to baseballoutsidethebox.com for the audio and YouTube, Peter Caliendo. Hey, subscribe to the show. And remember, it gets it all over the place. And that's what we need. We just need the show getting out because we think we've got some great, great guests that come on the show and great conversations today. We're delving back into pitching. I know we've done it a lot, but think about it. Pitching, man, it is so – people say it's easy. Well, you try it. It's not that easy, especially for the real young kids that have, you know, the ball's really big in their hand and they're only 8, 9, 10 years old and they're trying to pitch. Well, let me tell you, we've got somebody here, Hector Torres, who unbelievable experience, 23 years as a minor league pitching coach. He also coached in winter ball in Puerto Rico, Venezuela. He's traveled all over the world working with coaches. He's got a brand new book out called Unleash the Pitcher in You. Got to talk about that. And his website, hlbpitching.com, how you're learning baseball. We are going to get into more about what Hector's done in the game of baseball because he's done so much. He's got some great stories. He was a player in the Caribbean World Series. But we'll talk to him about that. Let's welcome Hector Berrios. What's up, Hector?
How you doing? I just want to say thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be part of your show. I've seen a couple of clips that you've shared with me, and I'm very excited to be here today.
I'll tell you what, I got to tell you, Hector, I got to thank our good friend in BC Baseball, one of the best baseball organizations in the world. And again, I've been fortunate to travel the world. So I think I can say that Grant Reimer, and we talked about it off the show, Grant Reimer, one of the board members with BC Baseball and pitching guy, you know, he was the one that recommended you. And let me tell you, I talked to you about half hour before the show and I could tell why he recommended you. So again, thanks for being on. And I thought, you know, an interesting way to start the show would be this. You know, you're born in Puerto Rico, a great baseball place, unbelievable. Matter of fact, right now they're in Florida competing in the Olympic qualifier, I believe, which is getting started. And you know, it'd be interesting, you know, what a baseball place. So tell us a little bit about you growing up there, you know, playing Little League and also why a lot of these, you know, kids from Puerto Rico come out to be some unbelievable players, not just in pro ball, but college and high school.
Well, I was born there and I was only there till about the age of 6. And then I grew up in New York City. So I went through all the baseball ranks and everything through the New York City system. But I was fortunate enough to be able to go back as a little leaguer and play against Roberto Clemente's sons and go to his house and see all the memorabilia back then, seeing all the talent because we were able to play around the island. But the most important thing is that I was able to go back as a professional and play winter ball. And it was to the point where I couldn't even speak Spanish anymore. I understood it because my mother spoke it at the house and my father, but I would never hear it again until I get home again. So anyway, to make a long story short, I get there and the Puerto Rican players would joke on me. They were like, hey, you freaking gringo. Hey, you this and you that, and you don't want to share time with us. I just couldn't speak the language. So that's why I stayed away from them. But with time and being in baseball long enough, you get to translate the information. And now it goes from understanding it to being able to verbalize it. And, you know, to answer your question, I was able to see the talent with Roberto Alomar and so many players that came out during the time that I was going there in the winter that it's just a beautiful thing to watch how it is, especially the catchers that develop out of Puerto Rico is amazing.
Yeah, and you hear, you know, I mean, we've talked about it on the show. You hear about, you know, again, I've been lucky. I've been to Cuba, Dominican Republic, Puerto Rico. But you hear about, you know, a lot of these kids, they play for the love of the game. You see that love when they're playing. I mean, you can see it in the big leagues. Javier Baez is a great example. Yeah, he's making money, but he enjoys playing the game. He's having a lot of fun doing it. Even during tough times, he's still having trying to keep up and have that fun. One thing is the passion, but then the other part is how much they play there, even the type of fields. I'm not sure they all have great fields all the time. They're uncomfortable, but they still play on those fields. Talk a little bit about that, how it helps young players.
Well, Puerto Rico is a little different because they have, you know, they're a commonwealth of the United States. So they have the facilities are better than in most other countries, neighboring countries. But they have a lot of education, a lot of instruction going on. But the one thing in regards to the passion is that you see it throughout the world now, but you see it in the Caribbean, in the Caribbean series or Dominican Republic or Venezuela. They have a passion and they're not afraid to express themselves. And then those players would come over to the United States and there's unwritten rules that you have to kind of follow and respect of the game and all those things. All of a sudden, those players started to change the way they were at the major league level. But then something happened, which was the World Baseball Classic, when they started playing for their countries, when they started to really have that passion and show and express, they hit a home run or they steal a base or they score, how everybody would come together. But it becomes a show for the fans. And now you're starting to see a transition into Major League Baseball because it's being allowed now.
Yeah, Hector, would you say that the kids in Puerto Rico, from what you've seen, they're great athletes? There's got to be a reason. Now, is multi-sport athletes a reason, one of the reasons for that? They just play a lot of sports? Or why do we see athletes coming out of there?
Well, baseball had a little bit of a time in Puerto Rico that they were competing with basketball. They have a league there that started to take a little bit of the attention away from the game. But then the Carlos Correas and the Baez and all of that, there was a new transition with the academies. The academies is what started this whole new movement with all these guys, the Rosarios, the guys that are in the big leagues right now. So it's more structured, more instructional, more catering to perfect games and all that, all the prospects are coming out because the Puerto Rican player is now part of the draft. So they're not like the other international markets. They're part of it. But I don't know. I just know that there's this thing that it's a small island and produces so many good, great athletes, especially at the big league level.
Absolutely. Love watching them play. You know, okay, so we're going to get into what you do with your website all over the world, teaching coaches and players. We're going to talk about the book. But before we do, let's jump into the heart of this. You know, the list of players that you've worked with that have made it to the big leagues is incredible. And so I want to jump into the pitching aspect of it right away. Let's start with the young kids, because you work with a lot of young kids too. Where are we going wrong with some young kids nowadays, and what do we need to change to make sure that they're developing as pitchers better and maybe not just only as throwers? Where do we start if you're a coach?
Well, I also see it at the higher level, and there's something that's, for me, been missing, and that is teaching how to pitch. And a lot of people are really not equipped to show that aspect because they haven't been in the trenches, is what I feel, enough to be able to formulate and learn and put together. I really believe that if they were to learn how to pitch early, it would be a little different. But now we have a lot of focus on mechanics. I mean, it's just like people are just stuck on the mechanical part. They also combine that with strength and conditioning. So you have two departments that in the middle, you're missing a big piece. And that's showing a kid from a young age. They're learning since they're in kindergarten. So you could teach a kid at a young age how to throw a pitch down and away, not on the corner, but, you know, middle of the plate, away and down. And it doesn't matter what level that you are pitching, that pitch produces a lot of weak contact. you know, because guys have a tendency to always pull off the ball. It happens at the big league level. So imagine at the lower levels when guys don't even know how to swing the bat yet. Mm. So it's teaching how to pitch, and that will minimize pitch counts, in my opinion. It would have guys, instead of trying to throw as hard as they possibly can, because now parents are seeing, wow, my kid is not throwing the velocity that this other kid is throwing. How do I get him to do that? But then they start doing it, being a little bit out of control. It's like driving a car down the highway 90 miles an hour, and a dog gets in the way and you swerve, you're out of control. But if you're going 55, you stand a better chance to stay on the path. So I truly believe that there is so much out of control movements in this day and age, trying to throw hard, that it's really leaving behind the most important part, and that's pitching.
Man, I tell you what, sweet words to my mouth. And, you know, because on the show, we talk about a lot, man, we've got to, you know, we're teaching the higher levels certain things, but we're not starting them young in the right areas. You know, like you said, throwing to spots. And I go back and I mention this, Hector, because I've been to Japan a lot and I love the Japanese, because, you know, the Japanese kids, you know, the difference between the Japanese kids and anybody in the world, I don't care who it is, mostly, you put the glove here
and they're going to hit
this close, right? We put the glove here with a 12-year-old. He misses over here, over here, over here. They don't. They are always in that area. Why? Because they focus on what you're talking about, throwing to location. Now, teaching how to pitch. Let's get into that, because I think that's critical. Talk about what that means, because do we start? Do kids need to learn how to throw first correctly? Then you got to build some mechanics, right? You got to have some mechanics, or are you teaching to pitch and hope the mechanics catch up to that?
Well, I believe that the delivery itself, the delivery, if you watch people dance and get on the dance floor, you see a lot of people dance off beat.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I'm one of them.
But now we get onto the pitching mound and you hear rhythm and timing and then tempo. So you hear rhythm and timing, and yet most people, when you look at it, they don't have a lot of rhythm and timing. So
and we're not teaching it either.
Was that?
We're not teaching that either.
Well, they try. We try as an industry, because that's, you know, how different philosophies are created. But you're teaching, let's just say that person gets on the mound and he doesn't have good rhythm. And how do you teach him rhythm and timing? Because a lot of people talk about tempo. For me, tempo is speed, and tempo is connected from one pitch to the other, maintaining a good tempo in the game. I'm a firm believer that the pitcher has rhythm and timing. That timing to be able to throw the ball and repeat that release point consistently. So how do I get my body in good rhythm so I can have good timing? If that makes sense. So once you start kind of developing that part where the kid can repeat to a certain extent, because you don't expect them to be a big leaguer overnight. This takes time, because when I work with guys, it still takes time where they rewire their movements and now create a different movement. It takes time for that to happen. But once you get that, then now we talk about pitching. A bullpen should not be thinking about mechanics. A bullpen should be taught about pitch selection and pitch sequencing. And any hitter that gets up to bat for the first, I don't care what level you're at, they're looking, especially in this day and age, middle in, so they can really sway the game with one swing of the bat. Mm-hmm. And you're going to do damage middle in to the shorter part of the park where you can pull the ball, but it's extremely hard to hit the other way. Extremely hard, because they have to let the ball get deeper. When they let the ball get to a certain point deeper, and if the ball is down, the bat is in a diagonal position, it creates a lot of foul balls over the dugout. And I've done my own research personally to watch what happens through video and be able to show my pitching staffs what occurs. But when they hit the ball deep in the zone and the bat is in this angle, you have three things that are in three different points. And that's the hands, the barrel of the bat, and the ball are in three different places on that outer half and down. And that's why you see balls shoot off to the first base dugout. So I want my pitcher to understand it. I don't want any pitcher nibbling. That's not what you want. I want them to throw down and away. So you take the half of the plate and you pitch to one half of the plate. And if I can get a kid to understand the things that occur when he makes that pitch, he's going to be more in tune to want to throw that pitch to that spot to get to see if the ball does go over the first base dugout. If he hits it a little bit out in front, now he missed it. He's swinging with his hands because he's running out of barrel. Here comes the ground ball to the shortstop of the third base, and they roll over. Or they hit a weak fly ball where the outfielders are running in versus running back in the gap. You know, so you're creating so much. And then that's what I would say, you establish that. Kershaw, Buehler, all the big top pitchers, they can throw that pitch whenever they want. They're pitching up here a lot, you know, at the top of the zone, but they can go to that pitch whenever they need to get them out of any trouble. So you can start having a young kid do that very young. So I have a catchphrase for that. Get the take. Get the take, because most of them are going to take it because they can't do much with that pitch. The coach teach them, don't swing at that pitch, please. Do you prefer to be 0-1 or 0-1? I prefer to be 0-1 so you can get another pitch. But if you're 0-1, you lost the at bat.
Yeah.
So why give it up with the first pitch that the pitcher makes? So they're not going to panic. They're going to let you pitch. Yeah. So that would be called get the take.
You know, and that's great stuff. I love that. You know, I was thinking because it sounds like you said when you're young, you got a huge advantage as a pitcher. Now, if you could locate, I mean, I remember having young kids, good hitters, in a cage, working with hitters, just tossing the ball underhand in those days and to locations. And we'd play a game, right? And they barely scored a run in the cage because I could throw it in and out, up and down, you know, across different areas, and they would struggle. And you wonder, well, why are we teaching that to young kids? So interesting. The question is, where do you start with this? When you talk about location and tempo and rhythm, where do you begin with a young kid? You know, how do you get them to understand that? They're just for our coaches, you know, some understanding of their drills or our mental area that you work with.
I have a 10-year-old girl. Now she's 11. I think she's 11 or getting to 12. Valerie. And Valerie lives in Coral Springs. Her father is a pilot for the Ford family. And he brought it to me. And he asked me to take on his 10-year-old kid. And I never knew because he didn't share with me it was a girl. So eventually goes, yeah, Valerie or Valentina? Valerie. So Valerie, and I would say Valerie. So he brought me this girl, and this girl is like phenomenal. She is, you know, we work with the target, we work with the delivery. And the most important thing was understanding that number two glove is what she's going to hit when she's pitching. So she sees the actual visual of the catcher, and we're just trying to hit that number two glove. That was the only thing in our head. But behind the scenes, there's a lot of sensory drills that I have the pitchers do. And one of them is I tie the bands, the resistant bands, handles for the arm, and throwing arm in the glove hand. And then I tie the ankles with the ankle brace, so strap. And what happens is that I tell them about the movement. I call it rolling the hips. I would tell you that when a pitcher lifts his knee to this side of his body, call it torquing or the scissor position, and then he rolls. And when he rolls that hip, it's almost like you're sending everything to your backside. We're not talking about dropping your back shoulder and your head. We're talking about rolling and driving your back leg. So you're trying to stay over your backside until you front foot strike. But when you put them in these bands, the resistance makes them feel what you're conveying to them. So they can mimic the movement based on feeling it, because the band is going to force them into feeling it. So that's the number one thing. All the drills that I incorporate in my system that I've created over time, it's all resistant. So we don't do a lot of throwing. We do more leveraging, using your legs correctly. We talk about the kinetic chain, how to use the kinetic chain, the resistant bands, the Velo Pro belt. You've seen that, right? The one that connects to the back. Well, it's funny because they advertise all of the videos that I put in on my site, on their site. It's because I incorporate another piece to it. I got a band where they strap it onto the backside, but then there's a strap that the hitters use that they do it under the kneecap. So I put a strap there, hooked another one of their bands to the front foot. So now they have an extended bungee cord that's forcing them to stay closed with the front side. So I'm not a firm believer of one side, feeling one side. I believe that the legs, it takes two to tangle. So you need to use both of them correctly. So they keep continuously put this drill, but the drill is for me to show the pitcher how to feel both legs working in conjunction with each other, how one helps the other. So the bands, it's another drill that's a sensory drill that will be able to get your athlete or your pitcher to be able to feel. Again, I'm explaining something to them and they could leave. It goes in one ear and out the other, but if they felt it, they're always going to remember it, especially if they have the equipment with them. Then we do, I have heavy balls. This is not a weighted ball program. It's weighted balls for them to feel their body and their legs turning and getting the ball into the position that they need to get it. It's not, it's, you know, all these kids that now they're doing this short arm stuff, Kelly, or Galito and
yeah, Galito with the White Sox.
Well, if you see them, they come from where their arm was real long.
Yeah,
they used to lose their arm behind. They used to walk away from their arm, you know, in the delivery. So they cheated or they take a shortcut so they won't be late with their arm. And it's just because they never gave their arm time to get to the bottom of the circle, get into external rotation, and deliver the ball. That makes sense.
Yeah. So what you're saying is, we need to teach them how to do it and not necessarily take the shortcut
the correct way, because it's there's so many analogies that I use. It's one is when God put us on this planet, he made us walk with this side. So I'm left-handed. So he wants my left foot with my right hand. And then once you finish that stride, you're walking opposite. Hitters have an advantage because they have both hands connected to the bat. So what happens when they stride, that bottom hand brings that shoulder back so they can stay connected to their lower half that goes to swing. So pitchers, their front arm has a mind of its own. A lot of times that arm just goes flying down the slope. It pulls the torso, spine, head, top heavy. And now you got guys pulling to try to throw the ball. So it's how do I get the guy, if I'm walking, I explain it this way. I finish my left foot stride. If I stick my foot out and raise my hand, that's where I should be when I'm pitching. So I should be torqued and allowing the lower half to now start the trunk rotation in the arm position. But if I walk away from the arm, now here goes the stress that people go through. And now you have injuries start to occur with that type of throw for a long period of time. So the big key for me and the pitchers I work with is the rolling, the driving, front foot strike, allowing that backside to start bringing the torso to deliver the ball.
Hector, you see a lot of young kids, and I'm talking about 13 and younger, especially. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that front side, the glove side. Some of them don't even use it, period.
Yeah, they're down, they're low, they pull.
It just sits there and they use their regular arm. So what is the heavier ball a correction to help them do that?
Yes, because the balls, it's heavy. This is, if anybody hears me talking about the weight, they think I'm crazy.
Right.
I have not one crazy part of my brain, but It's I got this from Jose Veras, who pitched for the Yankees, and he was always wild, but he had a 6-pound ball. And I was like, where did you get that ball? Anyway, to make a long story short, he used to have a funky arm angle. And I said, try this, because the ball was heavier and it's going to force him to feel to how he picks that ball up. And all of a sudden he did the throw correctly for the first time. I was like, wow. So later on, as I kept teaching, I grabbed the heavy balls, and the heavy balls were just so they can feel the lower half, the legs, bring it, you know, bring the rotation up and bring the arm where they can keep the arm and feel that arm path. Mm. They would literally feel that arm path. And it has gotten me so many great results because guys stay healthy. They stay healthy. They're never, you know, if you lift that ball up, that heavy ball, and go like this, that's, yeah. So when you start to realize is that they pick the hand above the elbow real quick. So the legs will allow this action to happen. And now you're in a good position because as the arm goes forward, the hand being in the 90 degree inside 90 brings the elbow into position. Now you have shoulder and tricep bringing the forearm forward.
Yeah.
So you're never allowing, you know, like coming up, walking away from your body and having that stress. So the balls have given me the ability to convey the message to the pitcher. And your question in the beginning, how do we teach a young kid? So I would get, you know, with Valentina, I would get very lighter balls, but enough where she can feel it. And the good thing about the balls is that they never gonna, you'll see the layback will never be like, you know, when they're actually thrown. The layback will just be here and it's just like pushing. But the most important thing, shoulder, back, and always having your decelerator go to the lat versus getting stuck in your shoulder. Which is what you see in this day and age.
If you're listening on the podcast, I mean, I think by listening, you should be able to understand that. But just in case there's a visual, go to YouTube, Peter Caliendo, watch the visual part. You can see Hector actually doing the motion. Man, it makes so much sense. Now, here's a difficult one. You hear people say, the Japanese are a great example. They pretty much teach everybody the same. The question would be, you teach everybody the same, or are there certain things that, because nowadays you hear, well, you got to let a guy or gal be themselves naturally and let them do how their body works. So how do you separate those two? There are certain things that you teach that are the same and certain things you let the body naturally do, or am I going in the wrong direction here?
No, you're going in a great direction. I had the guy that's been, and I've been with great pitching coaches in my career. Rick Peterson, Gil Patterson, the list goes on and on. Rick Honeycutt, the most influential person that I came across is a man by the name of Rafael Chavez. And he is, after 15 years of being in the game, I learned how to really use the lower half. And that's when I went to the Dodgers. So Rick Honeycutt was there, but the most other guy that combined to make that connection in my mind on how to teach the lower half was Sandy Koufax. Wow. I was a double A pitching coach and I was in big league camp and I was there with Sandy Koufax. And do you think I'm going to let that opportunity for 2 weeks?
No pass? Way.
I was on Sandy like white on rice, you know? And I said, I have this opportunity here. I had Davey Lopes there. And Davey Lopes and I worked in a station together. So that's another topic of conversation. But Sandy Koufax, one of the things that stood out, he simplified everything so well. The thing that the way he explains things was just so easy. But one of them was, the question was, do you believe in heel touch or toe touch, you know, or having the foot? And Sandy comes back and he goes, well, I believe in the heel because if God wanted me to land on my toe, he would have put my toe here and my heel here. Wow. That made so much of an impact. Aside from so many, my middle of the strike zone is down and away. I never throw a pitch down the middle, he said. Wow. You know, he learned that down and away was his spot. Yeah, he would never pitch in the middle. That's the hitter spot. My down the middle is down and away. And it was like, wow, that makes a lot of sense. But Rafi Chavez spent so much time explaining the lower half that it started to open up the thinking that I had. It was I had a set way of looking at the delivery, but he opened my mind up to see it a different way. And then ever since that, I saw more velocity increases than I had ever seen in my career. So obviously, like any coach, you take the best things that you learn and then apply it and you do away with the things that don't work or created injuries that you saw in your mind. And then you stay with the good stuff so you can continue to build a system that's gonna develop players the best that you've seen through the trajectory of your career.
All right, so Hector, so if we're talking about some mechanics, obviously you gotta understand the mechanical aspect, the movement. We got rhythm, timing, and tempo in there. Those things, along with what else, and the lower body, you know, again, you mentioned lower body, those things build velocity. So we're talking about working on location, timing, all these other things that then at the end, you'll get the velocity. But what else do we need to do? Do we need to include other things to gain some velocity or just those?
Well, I mean, I'm not a strength conditioning guy because when you're in professional baseball, everybody has their departments. Mm-hmm. I am a pitching guy, and I am not going to try to do something in my lane that requires something that other people go to school for and sure. learn. I have my PhD is in pitching. You know, it's not in strength and conditioning. So I leave that I work alongside with strength and conditioning, but I am not a big proponent on heavy lifting. And if you look at the history of the game, I saw Jack Morris come into the clubhouse when I was at the Detroit Tigers. That was the first time I ever saw any weights being talked about. And it was just the Job exercises with pound weights. Mm-hmm. And at that time, it was like a taboo to lift. But the thing that, you know, like Pedro Martinez said, I never did a push-up in my life, you know? So there was no strength and conditioning done with Sandy Koufax and all those guys. And they lasted for so many years.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden you look at the new age of pitching and guys like Syndergaard, the biggest, strongest, no shirt throwing pitcher go down like fly. Fernandez, Harvey. I mean, the list goes on and on and on and on. Guys are bigger and stronger, but they break down like nothing. You know, so overthrowing, possibly, you know, trying to throw hard. But how these guys, Tom Seaver and Nolan Ryan, doing a movement that is said that is not a natural movement, right? Throwing a baseball is not natural. If it's not natural, how did these guys last for 27 years and 20 years? Pitching without lifting weights.
Yeah.
So they just did it correctly. There's so many people that pitch and a lot of them do it incorrectly. The ones that do it correctly usually stand a better chance. In this day and age, Mariano Rivera, John Lester, these guys are never on the shelf because they work their lower half a lot better than most and they give their arm time and their follow throughs use their big muscle. So you take what was happening in the old era and then try to see how that can help this new era. So I see a lot of different things. I see the show. You're in the big leagues, you see a guy throw, the arm gets stuck right here, boom, there's a recoil, mm-hmm. and now here goes the show for TV. The leg comes up and around.
Right.
Constant. So when that leg comes up, it goes around, up and around, my upper body has to be upright. In the old days, you would see a guy throw, here come the shoulder, here come the lat, here come the glute, here come the leg on the follow through and land, boom. And they were more in fielding position. In this day and age, you see guys go here, that's it, the throw's done. A lot of stress right here because the braking mechanism stops right at this particular point. It doesn't give you the air brakes to take on the brunt of the braking mechanism. And then standing up, allows that leg to come here, and now is a show. And guys are out of position, a little ground ball up the middle, and they can't even feel their position. A bunt to the first base side, or swinging bunt that way, they can't get there.
Right.
So, you know,
and that reminds me, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but it reminds me because you look at a guy like Nolan Ryan, he threw pretty hard, and yet his momentum was going towards home plate. Now we got guys going right, left, and I know, and I see a lot of young kids, even on videos on YouTube, they're running as hard as they can. And I get it. They're trying to throw the ball as hard as they can, but they're just throwing it without even, there's no really body motion. It's just throw. Wherever the body goes, it goes just to get velocity. And that's a concern because we know this, Hector. We know past 87, I believe, and I don't want to misquote it, but past a certain miles per hour, the ACL can't handle it. So my concern is if we're not teaching proper movement, that's one of the reasons we're starting to see more injuries at the major league level, not just because of velocity, but also because of improper movement.
Well, I always stress how easy can I throw hard?
Yeah.
what you see nowadays is everybody's got these magic numbers of 100. So you have young kids trying to throw that velocity. But in reality, let's face it, if there's a 13-man rotation on each 30 teams, that's 390 pitchers that get the opportunity to wear a major league uniform. So it's easier, like they say, to be a doctor or a lawyer than it is to be a big league pitcher. Right. You can't lose sight of that. You can never lose sight of that. The backup plan is always, like they say, stay in school so you can be able to develop. If that plan A does not work out, then you have plan B. And in this day and age, there's so many jobs that people can get. But the most important thing is that the body is given the ample time for that arm to get into position. That's all it boils down to. If this arm does not get ample time to get into inside 90 and get external rotation and then allow the shoulder, the tricep to deliver the form, you're now extending those ligaments. Everything goes directly to the joints. You could get as strong as you can. Your rotator cuff doesn't get much stronger. You could only maintain it, but it doesn't like get stronger. So what ends up being injured? The small, bitty parts of the arm, not the muscles. Usually a flexor tendon, the UCL, right? Rotator cuff, labrum tears. But those are the small parts of the connective tissue that holds the joint together. If you don't give that connective tissue enough time for the big muscles to help it, then you put yourself in a position of risk of injury.
Love it. Hey, listen, the other part I was thinking about, here's a good one. I think we forget this, and you mentioned it because you're talking about location and visual, and you showed your target, which I want you to show here in a minute, that you developed, because I love that. Are we forgetting that the brain is, and you keep hearing this, the brain is so powerful that visually, if I'm looking at a spot and trying to hit that spot and working on it, as you mentioned earlier, along with rhythm and timing and all that, but you're looking at that location, that brain is so powerful, it can actually, I would assume, again, I'm not an expert, it would assume that it would start correcting the body in order to get that final result done by hitting that spot.
If you were to take your girlfriend, when you're young, to the amusement park, and you're going to try to knock down the three puppets, you're not going to be thinking, okay, hand separation, I got to stay close. You're just looking at that spot, boom. And if I miss to the left of it, I make the adjustment a little bit more here to try to hit it right between the nose so I can knock it back. If I missed it a little to the right, I know I yanked it. So now I'm making a hand-eye coordination. God gave us all the hand-eye coordination ability, some better than others, but it's developing the hand-eye coordination part as you do mechanics, as you do those other parts. So now my hand-eye coordination is what's going to get me to put the ball in the glove. There's more things to it. Aim small, miss small. You know, I learned a while ago when I was playing winter ball, a guy named Reggie Ritter came up to me and asked me, when you look at a glove, what is it that you look at? I'm a pitcher and I had already played double A. So it showed me how naive I still was about pitching because nobody had talked to me about pitching ever. It was just on natural ability. So I said, what do you think I look at? I look at the glove. He goes, wrong answer. Wrong answer. So what is the answer? He goes, the real good ones, the Roger Clemens, the at that time Saberhagen, all those guys, they look at an itty bitty spot. So they'll see a light come through the glove, they see a little lace, and that glove becomes huge. When they go throw that ball, they look at that little and they don't miss the glove. They stay in that glove. You, on the other hand, you go for the glove and you miss here. That could be the difference of down and away to middle to double in the gap to you backing up the bases. And that stayed with me to the point that it started to get my thinking. So he had drills for me. He goes, I want you to do this. We're going to BP going on. Balls are flying all over the place. And he goes, I want you to just think about looking at that little spot and throwing your fastball. So I started, I could throw strikes. So now all of a sudden my strikes became like command strikes, precise strike. So I started hitting that target. And then, by looking at it, that glove became big. I couldn't miss it. I mean, I was a professional. So all of a sudden, I just took my focus and concentration to a different level. And then the last thing I'll leave you with in regards to this is he said, okay, now you have a 2-0 count and we're going to throw breaking balls, right? So after he had me throw breaking balls for a strike, he goes, I'm going to give you a count and I don't want you to think about the count. I just want you to think about that little spot and hitting the glove. So the count does not make any difference in what you're trying to do. Mm. So, okay. 2-0, he would scream, you know, in the field, 2-0. So after the 2-0 count was in my head, he goes, I want you to eliminate 2-0 and just concentrate on hitting the glove. Forget about anything else. Just hit the glove. I want to hit the glove. And he goes, what's the count now? So the count could either put pressure so you could throw a ball, or you could just eliminate things and just concentrate on hitting, like I was at that amusement park hitting that puppet between the eyes.
So that's it.
What pitching came to me.
Yeah, and by the way, for our YouTube people, go ahead and show the target. I love that target. I think that's important. So, folks, if you're on the podcast at ESPN or also on Baseball Outside the Box, just check out Peter Caliendo YouTube.
Let me take off my video background.
To show it, yeah. There you go.
So these are this is the name of the target. It's Pro Command. I have it's online. You can buy it on Shopify. And then these are the targets that I was telling you. So I literally put that lace, and I actually put a light coming through the glove here. If you see that light coming.
Yeah. Through.
So that's in every single glove. And this is like basically the bottom of the zone. So you got the 2 and the 3 are right on the black of the plate. So you're throwing on the inner half of those.
Mm-hmm.
1 would be for breaking balls. Let's just say if you're working on throwing a curveball, slider, changer for a strike, you throw it down the middle, and then, you know, depending on the movement, it'll go to one of the gloves. And then you go lower. That's the 7 is the left-handed breaking ball to the right-handed hitter's foot, and the 6 is the righty to the foot of the left-handed hitter. And then you just go up top, and now you pitch at the top of the zone. You got the ones that create the swing, and the 8 is the one that creates a swing and miss.
Love it.
Specific locations for the pitcher to work on.
Yeah, I believe that I think we're missing a point, you know, with a lot of young players. I think you're right. We're not really focusing on, you know, the location aspect of it, because talk about this, you know, a lot of different pitches in different zones aren't just different locations, but they all change different speeds too, without even trying.
Well, the things that we talk about, again, you know, you hear the topic perceived velocity.
Mm-hmm.
But when you throw a fastball down and away, the hitter has to let it get deep in order for him to drive it. Where pitchers, and you look at ESPN all you want, and you look for this, Adrian Gonzalez said to our minor league guys, came down to have a session. And I'm a person that wrote everything down. I always wanted to come back and take something away from it and not miss one thing that was said. But he told the guys, he goes, everybody thinks that I'm a great hitter down in, you know, to the opposite field. I am. But I am only good if the pitch is down. I mean, away and up.
Right.
But if you throw down at the knees away, not even Barry Bonds could do anything with that pitch. And when he said that, it was like, oh my goodness. That's when the light bulb started to go on. And I wrote the chapter Cat and Mouse Game in my book, because I went on and on to talk about hitting philosophies and the advantages we could take of the hitters based on what they're thinking and what the coaches are teaching them. But when he said that, it's like, wow, now I get it. And that point one takes me to point two. So it's a journey. Every situation is different. So getting back to perceived velocity, that fastball down and away is going to be, let's say if you throw 95 in the middle of the plate, that'll be 94, 93. But if you throw that same pitch with 2 strikes, because 0-0 count, he can cheat to that pitch. So it's not going to look that fast, but he's got 2 strikes and you've established away. Now you've made your fastball be 2 different velocities, and people don't understand that.
Right.
So with the 2 velocities, you got 96, 97 of the 95, because he has less time to hit it and react, and he can't do it because he's got what we call the 63 ball effect. seven balls across the bottom, nine balls to the top. You times it by, you know, seven by nine, you get the 63. So he has to have the 63 ball effect that he has to worry about everything. He's not going to be turning and burning on a two strike, one, two. Usually the free strikes come when they have two strikes, no matter what the count is. You know, with two strikes. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, you know, it's a great example of what you're talking about because you said location. I saw a stat just the other day, 24% of major league fastballs hit their spot. That means they're missing that spot that many times. Well, then obviously the hitter's going to have a good advantage if you can only locate the fastball 24% of your time.
Well, the other day, Vladimir made his debut and he pitched like a seasoned veteran. Luis Castillo pitched the day after, and then that whole staff gave 10 runs and he gave up one on one swing of the bat. It was a home run to left field. But he understands this philosophy and he takes it to another level. He pitched in spring training to the Dodgers. And we always talk about that pitch. He struck out four guys. Three of them were on that fastball down and away. Pollock, Turner, and Taylor, three studs. They all looking on that pitch because it's hard to get to if you can locate it. So it's understanding what you're trying to do. The best hitters in the world still have trouble with that. So imagine
And coaches working with these young kids, listen what Hector's talking, man. I mean, concentrate on location, location, location. That's the same thing in real estate. They keep telling you, right? Location, location, location. Same thing in pitching. You know, you mentioned cat and mouse game. You're also seeing some pitchers, because you also talk about rhythm, timing, and tempo, but you also see some pitchers trying to break that rhythm, timing, and tempo. I always want, you know, you see them sometimes they stop or they have a double stop or they do something weird, you know. Does that affect their movement or is that okay?
Well, I have a chapter in my book on that. And that's, you know, talking about Stroman and Familia and Cueto. And I was in a hitting class. And the other thing I try to do is anytime in professional baseball there was a hitting class, I would sneak into that class and be like a fly on the wall to listen to what the hitting coaches were telling the hitters. And this one particular one, Frank Cacciatore was the name of the coach. He was talking about the front foot strike on the hitter. When he lands and he strides with the front foot, when they had the videos back then and they frame by frame it was 10 frames from when the pitcher released the ball to when it got into the hitting zone. So your foot as a hitter needed to be down on five or six of those clicks. If you did not have it on five or six of those clicks, you would be too early or you'd be too late. And I was like, that's interesting, right? So now here comes Stroman and here comes Familia quick pitching and Cueto and doing all those things. All they're affecting is the click. So they're not putting their foot down on five or six clicks to be on time. Yeah. So that's all they do. Being with Pat Borders, he caught during the steroid era. So you're talking about Canseco, you're talking about all these guys. So they're hitting the ball, not to the second deck, to the upper deck,
right.
Sometimes out of the park because they were so big and strong. So he's like, what do I do to throw off the timing of these guys? So what he did was he taught me this. And he goes, anytime we have a situation where we need to make a pitch and it's a fastball situation, we're going to give him the fastball. We're just not going to give it to him in this time that he's waiting for it. So basically he started going to the young catchers because they didn't understand the philosophy. He goes, if I go like this to you, you don't pitch. When I go like this, give the sign to the pitcher. So the catcher would look over to the dugout. And when he look over to the dugout, he's going like this. And then all of a sudden, when he does this, you see the hitter. I started to see this whole thing evolve. You see the hitter go like this, and then he'll stop his wiggle, and then he'll wiggle. And he's like, dude, are you going to throw the ball? You going to pitch? You could see that thought enter his mind. And here comes the pitch. All of a sudden, his foot got down late. Boom. Time and time and time again. That's when I started to understand what Stroman and those guys are doing. In our system, if he called timeout, if he got past the he's here, and then throw the ball, timeout, then when he steps back in, we quick pitch them.
Yeah.
So now you you did the complete opposite. And that would just throw off their timing. And that's how, you know, in the book, it explains it into more detail, scientific reasons on why these things happen. So
go ahead. I was just going to tell everybody, we're going to put all the information on the show notes on the book, Unleash the Pitcher in You. Also the website, hblpitching.com. So you can check it out, get a hold of Hector. Hector, the other part of pitching you hear is, you know, pitchers who release the ball too early, or pitchers that should be releasing it later so the ball gets there quicker visually. What's that all about? How do you work on that?
Well, when I was with the Phillies, one of the things that we had year in and year out, and the analytic guys were saying, they would come up to us like, why didn't the rest of the league, you know, like the rest of Major League Baseball, don't understand this? And we were teaching just the lower half that I just explained to you earlier. But the guy, the hyperextension of that front league leg block, that they call it nowadays, if your leg is going back, you're almost like, it's almost like sending your body back to go forward. And they talk about a car accident, a car crash. Everything goes forward when everything stops. I'm a big boxing fan. And Rocky Marciano, Manny Pacquiao, it doesn't matter, all the great, Muhammad Ali, when they threw a blow, Mike Tyson, their front leg, their knee would not pass their ankle. As long as it doesn't go past it, you don't leak any energy. They want even more to hyperextend it. So if you hyperextend it, your hip, as opposed to your hip going through the front side, it kind of goes up because it locks and it kind of, so there's a stopping mechanism just to get the upper body over the front side. What we teach is a little bit of a flex without it going past the ankle. And it allows this back hip to continue the process to allow that back into the throw. Hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And when you're teaching something like that, are there times with young players that you stop them in certain positions to let them feel what that's like, or is it always movement?
Well, when you start teaching, like the way we talk with the sensory stuff and we drive with the heel, they land on the heel. That thing, going back to Sandy Koufax, I don't know. I'm just watching, you know, as I'm working with guys, I'm starting to see, as I take video, I start to see this common thing happening, that if they do this right, they always land on their heel over here. If they do this a little bit off, their heel comes off, they start landing on their toes. You know, if they hyperextend, they lack extension out front. So we, because the way we taught the delivery, we're getting more extension, getting closer to the hitter, adding 2 to 3 more miles an hour visually to the hitter because we were getting closer. So the average major league extension was 6.1 to 6.2 around their feet. We were averaging 6.7 and more, you know, throughout the organization. It was just because we were teaching this delivery this way. They don't teach it like that anymore. But it would be like, look at, this is Vladimir the other day. I don't know if you can see. Oh, it's because of the, that's pretty cool.
That now, if you're on YouTube, you could see the extension.
Yeah, so he's connected to the ground and he's releasing the ball.
Right.
But you see how he's still flexed on the front side?
Yep.
If he was hyperextended, he would not be able to get there.
And you're seeing this, and then folks on audio, I'm kind of leaning forward with my arm. You're seeing this more than your body upright releasing the ball.
Yes. Let me, so you can see it clearer. Look at it now. You can see it there.
Yeah, perfect. Love that.
So he's still connected. This is on Friday when he pitched. You see, like, we use the leg that people would probably think that's overstriding, but he didn't overstride. This is where his legs got to. Mm-hmm. But you can see those, the legs are being used.
Yes.
If that leg was hyperextending back, it just, for me, it doesn't look like Lester and Sam. That's the same view. But if you can ask another question if you want, but I'll just give
you. I was just going to add, you know, the part that you said earlier, you know, you've got experts, obviously athletic trainers, work on these things. And the other part of it is the flexibility. You know, a lot of young kids don't have the flexibility because we don't work on it. So how do you get to those spots?
Well, that's funny. I had an experience during the pandemic we had all of these prospects that came with the Phillies, and after a year, after 3 years, they kept looking at their numbers, and their numbers kept getting flexible wise. They kept losing flexibility and mobility. So it gets tighter and tighter. So what started to happen? They were getting so strong. And where they're getting so strong? In the legs, right? They're going to do every squat in the universe. You know, the Russian squat, the this squat, the whatever squat and lunge, they were getting so strong that they were so tight. So now I get a guy to the mound and I'm asking him, I need your front knee to get to your back shoulder so they can roll. They can't even get their knee past this point because they were so tight. The pelvic area would not allow it. So they started to lose the function. So that can go in two ways. And one thing that you see, strength and conditioning organizations and companies have different viewpoints on what strength and conditioning is.
Yeah.
So I also was involved in the infant stages of strength and conditioning when it was like a football guy doing football exercises with baseball players. And then the name baseball specific started to come because there were so many injuries. So there's been a lot of things that have not gone right or according to plan. And a lot of different shifts and pivots have gone into this, you know, strength and conditioning way of looking at things. Sure. So now we have outsiders, right, who were consultants looking at the inside of what this organization was doing. And now there's going to be conflict because now they're going to go to the consultant to try to figure out the problems. So I'm watching this and I'm like, whoa, you got to be very careful with the strength and conditioning part, because there could be a point where the guy gets too strong and it doesn't allow him to do the functional stuff on the field.
Understandable. Hector, we got about 10 more minutes left, you know, and there's so much to pitch in. And obviously the things that you've taught that in your book, and we're going to finish with the book and talk about the book a little bit, but what areas have we not discussed that are so critical when teaching pitching that can help our coaches in the U.S. and around the world?
Well, I can only speak for myself and what has worked for me, because I can't speak for other companies or other people that do certain things that are very popular in this day and age. But what has worked for me is the drills, and every drill that we teach our pitchers always reinforce the pitching movement, because I can have a guy step back and run, or he could run as fast as he could and throw the ball. Those are all different types of throws that when you get on the mound, you can't replicate. So for the pitcher to start understanding how to move that body, but through resistant work, is where I believe the bridge has been formatted and built, where the guy can cross from one side to the other, where he used to be to where you want him to go.
Are there videos that you have on YouTube or anywhere else to show some of the drills?
To tell you the truth, I have not displayed those because those are like my inner things that I do behind the scenes.
Sure.
But I am in the process of doing online courses on my website, and that's where I'm going to put all that stuff up. I already have it all laid out with the big leaguers that work with me doing the drills.
So Hector, when you look at a page, so if I got coaches working with, again, I'll use young kids, but I'm sure it's all of them. You get them now, you got them now, maybe the first time you see them, talk about, you're going to look at them, and then you're going to try to identify what they need to work on and then tailor the drills for that specific area?
Well, I had a kid call me from Georgetown University the other day. His father, they live in Rhode Island. And I had to put him on the video, right? His video. And I matched it up with Vladimir Gutierrez, for example, and show him what Vladimir is doing to give his arm time versus what he was doing to have lack of time, to have less time. So, you know, one, I'm explaining to him so he can literally understand and see. And he goes, wow, that makes a lot of sense. So, I mean, that's the thing that you're able to do as an instructor
Again, great point, because you got Vladimir that you could use. So talk to our coaches. Who else would you model a little bit? Because if you're looking at a youngster and you're saying, okay, we're going to put the big league guy, the video, and then put the youngster there, and the coach can do that and right. work with the player on that. Who else would you model currently?
Currently, I would John Lester, if you're a left-handed pitcher. Mm-hmm. And people are going to say, well, you can't teach everybody the same way. But if a kid came and a kid is tight, for example, and he comes into your class to take karate for the very first time, would you say that kid can do a split for the first time? It's like, oh, he's going to be crying. And then they're going to do everything possible. You come back 3 months later and you see that same kid. His pelvic area is already loosening up. His groin area, his hamstring, everything is starting to loosen up. So his movements are getting bigger. Now he's able to throw those high leg kicks. I believe the same thing with what I've done. Guys start to get a little bit more range of motion because that's what we're working. Like I said, we are reinforcing the movement. So if the movement is done on a consistent basis, he's going to continue to loosen up. You have to watch on the other end if he's doing something that's causing this movement, you know, not to be able to be done the correct way, if that makes any sense.
Absolutely. All right, let's finish it off. Unleash the Pitcher in You. Talk about the book, but talk about what's in it and why coaches should buy this particular book.
One of the things that I did was I talked about the history of the game, the history of pitching, the way it was to where it is today, and the differences. So they can at least get a grasp, because from like, I would say the 90s, like 89 on down, it's almost like it's been deleted from baseball.
Right.
And it's like, we never go back to that. So because we're selling this movement, we don't see the great things that happened back then. Leo Mazzoni, I read his book and he said, you know, he had the guys throw two bullpens in between, but his bullpens were never at 100%. He said, the only time that you get hurt is at 100%. So we see kids throwing 100%, 100%, 100%. Something's got to give, and that's why you start to see all these injuries. He had Tom Glavine, Smoltz, all these great pitchers for, you know, 10 years being in the playoffs and all that, and stayed as healthy as you could possibly be. So I've taken that to heart, and that's the way I've always thought. I don't want to put my pitchers in a position that they're going to hurt themselves, but they can leverage themselves. So I kind of speak on that. My belief system, all the things, the topics that I talk about, from delivery to the throwing programs and everything in between, through the game plan, all the catchphrases, the controlling the running game, the mental side. It's the preparation that goes into being able to take the mental side and apply it in a game situation, focus and concentration. There's so many things in this book that touch and tap into so many things that I've learned from Roy Halladay being in the same room with me. I posted a no-hitter that he threw in the playoffs, and I had him explain every single pitch that he was making and why he was making it, to who he was making it, to the kids in the room, and it was like fascinating. But things that he mentioned, just a quick point real quick, and he said, I when I go into the game, Hector, I always anticipated two bad innings. So when those two bad innings arrived, I was ready for those two innings. I would be able to get out of the inning because mentally I was prepared for the difficulty. When it came, I was already ahead of the game.
Interesting.
So that is something that he came. I'm going to have two of those, he said. And then I learned from somebody else that he's going to give his pitchers two troubles. And if there's a third trouble, he's not going to allow that pitcher to ruin the game for the rest of the team. So he gives his pitchers only two troubles, unless he's a Roy Halladay or Clayton Kershaw, one of those guys. And then lastly, I learned from Orel Hershiser how to slow the game down. In the middle of chaos and things are going fast in the game, he said, what I would do is that I would step on the grass. Once I would step on the grass, that allowed me to scan the situation, look at the scoreboard, see who's hitting, who's behind. So I knew what was going on, how many guys were on base, what I needed to do. Once I stepped on the dirt, that gave me the indication of now I have to think which combination of pitches are going to give me the result that I'm looking for. So he already went boom, boom. Now I step on the mound, clear the mechanism like the movie, and I just have to execute pitches and get the result. So these are the types of things that I'm able, because I've been privy at the professional level to be around so many great people.
Great.
To be able to formulate a plan.
Great stuff. We're going to put all that on the show notes, how to get the book. Is the book you can get on your website, I believe, right?
On Amazon. You can get that on Amazon.
Fantastic. Yeah. And, you know, when you mentioned chaos, I'm thinking about an 11-year-old kid trying to throw, you know, in a 2-foot strike zone, 17-inch plate, you know, ball that's too big, and with people going nuts in the stands, you know, yelling and screaming, and here's this little guy trying to, a guy or girl trying to throw a strike. That's chaos. That's tough. I know it's tough in the big leagues, but it's also tough for those little kids because of everything around them. And I think that's what you said. Teach them early how to deal with that. It becomes easier when you get older.
That's part of the chapter in the book on how to focus and concentrate. It's called a pre-pitch routine. How to get, when you throw the ball, there are so many things that I call it my inner secrets of the things that I put together over time to create a system. And it has given me tremendous results at the big league level. With guys getting there, it's like a phenomenal rate of how fast they get there. But how to focus before a pitch and mm-hmm. how to do it. So that's one aspect. What I just mentioned that Oral Hershiser, right? That what I learned from him, and yep. then taking that, and now I have what they call a 3-step drop to create anxiety in the hitters. The hitter don't even know that you're doing this to him, but then you see those guys going, wait, let me get ready. Wait. And then they step in and then they put their hands on the bat. It's how to make the guys do that. So that's another thing that a young pitcher could learn how to do. It's very simple. And then when you're looking down on the dirt, how to pick up a little pebble. And then once you pick up a little pebble, go a little further and pick up a blade of grass. And then keep walking your vision all the way to the feet of the catcher. And then look up to the glove, boom. But this happens real fast. You create a little routine. And then he starts to focus on what he actually is trying to do before he does it. And then all of that thing that's getting him nervous, the parent screaming at that level, umpire made a bad call, a guy made an error behind him, he can focus and now rechannel his energy to make that one pitch. And then the next pitch, and then the next pitch.
Wow. Fantastic, folks. Hey, listen, you know, it is a podcast. We can only get so much information in a podcast, but still great stuff. And, you know, we're going to put, like we said, the book, Unleash the Pitcher in You. We're going to put that on the website. This is a must get book. You got to get it, especially if you're not, you know, if you're a coach any level, but especially if you're a coach of the young levels with the young kids, get this book. Hector, man, this has been fantastic. You know, never met you. Again, Grant Reimer saw a bunch of stuff you did, loved it, and he kind of, you know, connected us. I really appreciate it, man. It's been a great, great show.
Well, it's funny because you meet people, and in this short time that you and I have been together, it feels like I've known you forever. So
yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? I love it.
I hope it's not the first or the last time that we work together.
No, I got a feeling we're going to be doing some stuff together, not just in the U.S., but around the world. So again, man, special thank you, Hector. Have a great, and by the way, folks, my apologies. Have a great Memorial weekend and Memorial Day, special day for people who sacrificed their lives for, you know, allowing guys like Hector and I to do things we're doing, what you're doing in your life. You know, without those sacrifices that people made, we wouldn't have this great opportunity in this great country. And again, I apologize for not saying that at the beginning. That should have been forefront in the podcast. But again, have a great Memorial Day, Hector, and we'll talk soon, man.
I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
All right, everybody. That's Hector Torres. I'm Pete Caliendo.
Berrios.
Why did I say Torres?
I work with Hector Torres.
Did you work with Torres?
Yeah.
I told you when the show was started, I'll screw up somewhere, right? Well, there you go. I did it. Hector Berrios. Folks, Pete Caliendo, this Baseball Outside the Box. Don't forget, go to baseballoutsidethebox.com for the audio. Go to YouTube, Peter Caliendo. Check out all the shows on YouTube. Subscribe, and you will get all the updates on the new shows. Everybody, stay safe Memorial Day weekend. Remember, stay healthy. God bless you all, and we'll see you on the baseball field soon. We'll see everybody on the next show. See everybody.
This has been Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Listen online at baseballoutsidethebox.com and subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and all major podcast outlets. Join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Get all of our podcasts now at lineupmedia.fm.